Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Manlier Jerusalem series on ideas. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host, and I'm honored to welcome Jeffrey Sachs to the show today to talk about his new book, Agnon's Tales of the Land of Israel. Jeffrey Sachs is a rabbi, educator, writer, and editor, as well as one of the world's leading experts on the Nobel Prize winner, Israeli writer S.Y. Agnon. Sachs edited the 15-volume series of the annotated English translation of Agnon's writings, published by Toby Press. He's also director of research at the Agnon House in Jerusalem. In addition to all that, he is the founding director of Atid and its webyeshiva.org program. Jeffrey Sachs, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Renee.
You've accomplished a great deal in your multifaceted career, Jeffrey. Tell us a little bit about who and what were the significant influences on your own intellectual development.
Oh, my. Well, as you pointed out, I have a very varied CV. And like, you know, many people, I simultaneously work at a variety of different jobs, all interrelated, all connected to the world of Jewish life and learning and literature. For many years, I was a conventional teacher of Torah, of Jewish learning. I'm a rabbi. I studied and graduated from Yeshiva University in New York. I taught high school in America. And then in my mid-20s, I came to live here in Israel, and I've taught at a variety of different yeshivot and midrashot and institutions, principally those that are attended by American students that come to learn for a year or two here in Israel. And a number of years ago, I became interested in deepening my engagement with the writer Shai Agnon, as you mentioned, Hebrew literature's only Nobel laureate. And even though I had a long connection to reading Agnon, I became something of an expert in his writing, and I had the opportunity to start teaching. You know, the only way to really become truly expert at anything is to teach it, to become involved at the Agnon House in Jerusalem, which is a very important and worthwhile institution. And I encourage all of our listeners to come and visit us at the Agnon House. Those of you here and those on your next visit to Jerusalem, it's the home in which he lived and wrote much of his work. And today serves as a museum and a cultural site and study center. And through that, I became involved in translating Agnon and writing about Agnon and involved in the world of research. So because I have so many different involvements in professional involvements, so the question of what were the great influences on me are, you know, is a question that we could, you know, spend a whole separate podcast on the life of Jeffrey Sachs, which, you know, I assume our listeners are less interested in. But there were a variety of people in my life, teachers and rabbis and friends, who shaped my intellectual world. I should mention that one of them, Rabbi Shalom Carmi of Yeshiva University, served as my co-editor of this volume that we're talking about, this collection of essays about Agnon's writing. This is a volume that came out of a conference that was held at Yeshiva University, co-sponsored by Agnon House in Jerusalem and Yeshiva University's Center for Israel Studies, that was held in 2016. In commemoration of the 50th anniversary of Agnon's Nobel. And Shalom Carmi and I edited the volume that we're talking about today. And among many people, he was one of the great influences on my life, and along with many other figures.
How fortunate to be able to work directly with one of the great influences on your life.
Right.
Well, okay, let's turn to the book and the man, Agnon. Who was Shmuel Yosef Agnon? When and where did he live? What distinguished him from his literary contemporaries? Give us a picture of the man and his time.
We're recording this conversation, unfortunately, in the middle of this terrible, tragic, events that are happening in Ukraine, which was Agnon's ancestral home. Of course, when he was born there in 1887, it wasn't Ukraine. He lived in Galicia, which was the easternmost province of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He was born in a little town called Buchach. And in the last few days, I've been inundated with questions from people who are paying attention to the news and know about these atrocities that have been happening in a town, a suburb of Kyiv called Bucha. And people are asking me, is this the same town of Agnon? It's not. It's many hundreds of miles away. Agnon's town was in the what today is Western Ukraine. But Buchach was a small town. At the time he was born there at the end of the 19th century, it had about 12,000 residents, 60% of whom were Jewish. It wasn't a little shtetl. Very often, because we're very image poor, people read Agnon's stories of that old world, and they illustrate the stories from the images in their mind, in the catalog they keep in their mind, images that they may be familiar to them from having seen Fiddler on the Roof, which is, of course, a completely different milieu. Shalom Aleichem's world, Fiddler on the Roof, the Tevye stories, that's the Pale of Jewish settlement of the Russian Empire, which is separated by a border, a completely different empire. Agnon is born in Galicia, which is part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he lives there. He grows up in a what we would identify as an ultra-Orthodox environment. But that world was, relatively speaking, quite open. And in the home in which he was raised, he sent to cheder, the traditional Jewish schoolhouse. And then at a certain point, because he's recognized as a very gifted student, he's released from cheder. He's released from having to go to school, and he studies independently in the Beit Midrash, the study hall, and he studies with his father, who was a rabbi and a learned man, even though he made his living as a merchant. And but nevertheless, he was exposed to the great works of world literature and Hebrew and Yiddish literature that had come before him. And from a very early age, he sets his sights on becoming an author. He starts publishing his first piece of published writing. I think he's 14 years old. He writes initially first in Yiddish and in Hebrew, and at a certain point he makes the decision to commit himself to being a Hebrew author, which was a quite unusual choice at that time, because there were many, many, many millions more Yiddish readers than there were Hebrew readers. The flowering and flourishing and revival of Hebrew as a modern language was something that was still in its initial stages. At around the age of 20, he comes on Aliyah to the land of Israel, where he establishes himself very quickly as among the rising stars of this new culture and literature. And even though at that moment, he, like almost every other young man of the second Aliyah, that wave of immigration in the decade before the First World War, he abandoned traditional observance, he nevertheless remained very, very rooted in the sources of Jewish tradition, which he mined to craft his modern stories. And that really is, to a certain degree, it could be said that that's the main theme of his writing. The engagement of modern literature as crafted out of the classical Jewish bookshelf, from the Bible and the Midrash and the Talmud, and going up to Hasidic literature, medieval Hebrew literature and poetry, of course, up to Hasidic literature and those that came before him. He spent a number of years in Germany, which coincided with World War I, until in 1924, he returned to the land of Israel. At this time, he comes with a wife and two children in tow. And he has also at that point returned to traditional observance. So those that are familiar with images of Agnon, particularly the one that for many, many years was on the 50 shekel note here in Israel until the money was recently redesigned. He's sporting a large black yarmulke and continued from that point on, from midlife on, to maintain a traditional lifestyle. But he wrote in a wide variety of genres, from very short stories to long, sprawling modern novels, from kinds of a neo-pietistic tales that the naive reader might think are just, you know, iterations of an old Hasidic folklore, although if they do, they're missing the modernity that Agnon has introduced to it, to hyper-realistic modern novels, to surrealistic, nightmarish works for which he was compared to Franz Kafka, although that was a comparison that he bristled at very much. As I mentioned, in 1966, quite advanced in age, he's awarded the Nobel Prize, the first Israeli to receive a Nobel in any category, and to this day, the only Hebrew author so recognized.
Well, he had quite a life. And you say he published his first piece at age 14, but he says he wrote his first song at age 5 out of longing for his father, who was away on a business trip. Tell us about how the theme of longing continued to permeate his works.
Yeah, it's central to his writing. Longing for a world that's lost, longing for home. The whole nostalgic genre, which of course nostalgia, it means it not the way that we colloquially use it. You know, like if you see an old friend, you know, from school days, or somebody that you may have gone to summer camp, and you get to talking about those old stories, and you're laughing, you feel nostalgic. That's not what nostalgia is, technically defined. Nostalgia is the pain of knowing you can't go home again. You can't turn back the clock. You can't recapture what was lost. And that is a thread that runs throughout all of Agnon's writings. It's the way that he explores the tensions in modern life, in Jewish life. The gap between the old world and the new, between tradition and modernity, between a world where faith is kind of baked into existence, to a world of doubt and question, and even people of faith in the modern world have to earn their faith in ways that could be taken for granted in the pre-modern world. These are the great ideas that he's exploring in his writing. So that story that he tells, and like much of his biography, I mean, everything in his biography, from the date of his birth to his name almost everything is. I don't want to say fictionalized. I often say instead midrashicized. I hope our listeners understand what I mean by that. But the creation, the character of S.Y. Agnon himself, who serves as a character in many of the stories, who is usually identified as the narrator of the stories, even when he's not taking a role within the story, that character is the greatest character in all of his writing. The projection, the authorial projection of the autobiographical into the story is itself a creation. So he tells this story that the first song that he composes, he was of course principally a prose writer. His poetry would not have earned him a Nobel Prize. But his first literary composition was a kind of rhymed couplet that spontaneously erupts from him out of longing for his father, who has gone off traveling for business, and he's longing for absent father, who is both the source of authority, the source of tradition, but also a very important and significant beloved figure. Agnon had a very happy childhood, and even in his fiction, he does not feel compelled to kind of create a conflict and disharmony and strife, which is, you know, so common in modern literature, modern literary depictions of the family. You know, think of uh, Think of other authors. Think of Philip Roth's work, where there's also a very significant pseudo-autobiographical layer in his work. And I think Roth once said that, besides saying that he wrote novels in the form of confessions and people confuse them for being confessions in the form of novels, but, the reader could be forgiven when the protagonist of a novel set in the Weequake section of Newark, New Jersey is named Philip Roth. You might be forgiven for thinking that this is autobiographical. Right. But Roth said that, his family life was actually much more pleasant than that depicted in his novels, because if he wrote what it was actually like, it'd be quite boring. Authors usually feel the need to inject conflict into the story in order to move a plot. Agnon's depictions of his childhood are the most harmonious in all of his writings. They're the least nightmarish of what he's depicting. He had a very happy life, a very happy childhood, and that's depicted very clearly. And he had a very positive and warm relationship with his parents. He doesn't need to invent conflict. But there's a scene where father, who at this point is his teacher, with whom he sits and studies principally the Talmud many hours a day, who's supportive. And I mean, Agnon was something of a spoiled child. He was the eldest in his family, and he was recognized as a genius and talented, and every desire he had was granted. He also grew up not wealthy, but relative to the world at that time, he grew up in some privilege and comfort. And father goes away, and there's an anxiety when father is gone. Now, you don't need to be a scholar of Midrash in order to unpack the symbols that father is the autobiographical father, but it can also be interpreted as a symbol of father who art in heaven, and the distance between the Jewish people and the divine, and the insecurity that creates. And while he's standing at the handles of the lock of the door, a symbol he's borrowing from the Song of Songs, Al Kapot HaManul, he breaks out crying because he knows his father isn't here. And what comes out of his sobs is a rhyme. Efo ata abba abba, v'anochi ahavticho ahava rabba. How much I love you, father, father, where are you? Where can you be found, father, father? And I love you with a love which is most profound. And he's enchanted by the idea that this kind of spontaneous wailing that comes out of him is itself a literary creation, because it comes out as a rhymed couplet. And it's a kind of portrait of the initiation of the, not even the artist as a young man, but the artist as a young boy who finds solace in creativity. That literary creation itself is a response to suffering. And that becomes a central idea in all of his writings, until the point where he's standing as an old man. He's nearing 80 when he receives the Nobel, which is quite a bit older than the average Nobel laureate. Most Nobel laureates, when they receive the literature prize, have another novel or two left to write. Agnon was already nearing career's end. From that point on, he published no more books, although some stories were coming out and there was a lot being done that was published only posthumously. But when he receives the Nobel Prize, he very famously says, "Mitoch katastrophe historit," on account of the historic catastrophe that Titus of Rome destroyed Jerusalem and banished the Jewish people in 70 CE. 2,000 years ago, Nolarati ani b'achat me'orei hagola. I was born in one of the cities of the diaspora, but I always imagined myself as one born in Jerusalem. So you see this long arc of trying to come to terms with longing and loss from the personal, from the microcosm of the little boy missing his father, to the Jewish people missing their father in heaven, to the Jewish people missing their home, here being the land of Israel, to the return to the land of Israel, but ever mindful of like this 2,000-year gap in Jewish life, that runs throughout. And it actually intersects very much with the themes that we explored in the conference and the book, which is his depiction of the land of Israel, because his depiction and connection to the land of Israel is filtered through the nostalgia that he also feels for Jewish life in the old world, in Eastern Europe. And Eastern Europe is filtered through the depiction of the longing for the land of Israel. Everybody's always standing on one shore, maybe looking in a different direction, or having reached a destination, looking over their shoulder at what was left behind.
A psychologist, in listening or reading about Agnon's happy childhood and deep attachment to his father, might speculate that attachment is also a reflection, or is later reflected in the spirituality that permeates so much of Agnon's writings. In the book we're discussing, there's a chapter by Moshe Simkovich on Agnon's story called The Covenant of Love. And if you recall, it's a conversation among three elderly immigrants to Israel who are sitting on the beach at sunset, talking, complaining.
On the beach in Yafo.
That's right. Jaffa.
Yeah.
And they're complaining, as immigrants everywhere do, about how their new home fails to measure up against the old country. Tell us about the metaphor of light that's used by the speakers, and how the different points of view are resolved.
Right. So that story, the covenant of love, in Hebrew it's called Brit Ahava. It's a very, very short story, which is available the story itself is available in English translation, of course, in a volume that we put out with the Toby Press called Forevermore and Other Stories. And as you said, it's these three European Jews who have come late in life to the land of Israel, and they're sitting in Jaffa. And they're exploring this, where they're looking at the setting of the sun, and that gets us to this theme of light. But to discuss the theme of light, of course, you're also discussing implicitly the theme of darkness. And actually, Moshe Simkovich in this essay, which I think is a very good example of unpacking Agnon's use of the primary sources in the Bible, in the Talmud, in interpretation of the Bible. And very often Agnon will quote a source, a verse in the Bible. And the knowledgeable reader, even if they're reading in translation, will identify what Agnon is playing off of. In other words, it's not a quote in the mouth of the character who himself is quoting the Bible. It's just kind of intertextually woven in to the story. But even when we identify that source, what's required to really unpack the symbol is usually our ability to know how the reception history of that source, how that source was interpreted and read through the eyes of the Midrash and through the eyes of the biblical interpreters of the medieval period. Here, Simkovich is doing that through the prism of the commentary of Rashi on certain verses. But what's significant in this story is that the three of them arrive in Yafo, and to sit on the beach of Yafo looking at the sunset, of course, means looking west, looking back to Europe. In other words, it's an inversion of Judah Halevi's well-known phrase that I am at the furthest reaches of the West, but my heart is in the East, Libi b'Mizrach, he says while standing in Spain, looking and longing eastward for Zion. Here are three Olim who've achieved the goal of coming and settling in the land of Israel are looking out over the Western horizon at the end of the day. And they're wondering about the gap between what Israel was idealized and what it actually is now that they've gotten here. And that's a theme that also runs throughout Agnon's work. It's a theme that's very prominent in Agnon's great epic novel, Tmol Shel Shom, or in English, Only Yesterday, which is a central focus of many of the essays in our collection. Tmol Shel Shom is a novel told through the prism of the protagonist, a young man named Yitzhak Kummer, who arrives. He's not autobiographical, but his life overlaps with the stations in Agnon's life. He's born in Buchach, the same time as Agnon. He comes on Aliyah the same time that Agnon had arrived in 1908, the beginning of the 20th century, during this wave of immigration called the Second Aliyah. He settles first in Jaffa and then in Jerusalem, and he's torn between the secular modern life of Jaffa and the traditional religious Orthodox life of Jerusalem in that period, between the new settlement and the old. And that theme of Israel as we always imagined it would be, you know, because for 2,000 years, Jews sat in the diaspora and they, three times a day, they would face east, and they would pray to Jerusalem. They would long for Jerusalem. But Jerusalem existed more as a kind of abstraction, as a point of desire, than as an actual physical city in the minds and hearts and imaginations of diaspora Jewry, wherever they were. But when those that actually arrived here in the 19th and 20th century, well, you know, aspiration and abstraction and desire and idealization crashes up on the hard rocks of reality. Life was very, very, very difficult. And, you know, I dare say that, you know, even now in the early 21st century, I came on Aliyah, you know, about 30 years ago in the mid 90s. You know, I think most Olim would describe a similar type of crashing up against reality. Even those of us that have had very happy and successful lives, the immigrant experience is a difficult one, no matter how much it's padded. And that's depicted in Agnon. But through Agnon, it's depicted through an additional layer of, well, what do you do when you take with you in your suitcase, you know, on the boat, you know, arriving on the shores of Yafo in 1908, in your suitcase are all of those desires and expectations and idealizations of this place. And how do you make sense of it in the actual real physical world? The difference between the physical and the spiritual, the difference between the ideal or the real and the ideal. So I think in this question of light, you know, it's not so clear. Light casts shadow, and light is the mirror side of the other side of the coin of darkness. And, you know, this gap between the ideal and the real are things that they're exploring. Although that story, the story that Simkovich explores, ends on a kind of positive note. It ends on a kind of optimistic note that maybe those idealizations, the folklore, we have to outgrow that in order to actualize the covenant of love, the Brit Ahava, which God has formed with this particular land. But like any covenant, it's two-sided. And maybe what he's saying there, and in other stories, is that if the land of Israel, and this story is written in 1925, long before the establishment of the state, but if the land of Israel, and later the state of Israel, is not what we imagined it to be in our folklorish idealization, maybe that's on us. Maybe we have to work to make it what we imagined it is or could be.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
One of the chapters that I found very interesting was your conversation with Professor Avraham Holtz. You and he and the audience shared an amusing back and forth about the different Hebrew accents of Jews from different countries. And the conversation reminded me of Zionism's extraordinary project of taking an ancient language, which was used for sacred purposes only, and making it a language for everyday conversation and secular literature. Tell us about the role Agnon played in that transition.
I will, but before I do, since you've mentioned Professor Holtz, I'll just mention that to my mind, this is this was the most special part of the conference and the book. Avram is a I'll call him a dear friend, but he is of course our great teacher. He's one of the lead. I call him the dean of Agnon scholarship at this point. His most significant contribution so far is an annotated edition of Agnon's novel Hachnasat Kala. In English, it's called The Bridal Canopy, which is laid out and almost like a page of Talmud with the prime text in the middle and copious commentary and illustrations and source work and indexes and appendixes and etc., which unpacks every word, not even every line, every word of Agnon's text. And for many years, for many decades now, he's been at work on a companion volume of Agnon's great novel of life in the land of Israel, Tmol Shel Shom, which we mentioned a few minutes ago. And we hope that he will succeed in completing that work, which will be a phenomenally important contribution to Agnon scholarship, to the scholarship of Hebrew literature and of Jewish learning in general. So the conversation that I had with him at the conference, which was then edited into the essay in the book, explores his work as the great commentator and annotator of Agnon's work, particularly here on a novel focused on the reality of life in the land of Israel. But in terms of your question about Hebrew, it's a very important one, and we don't have time to fully discuss it here. But suffice it to say that when Hebrew was being what colloquially is called revived at the beginning of the 20th century, there were debates about how to go about doing that. How do you take a language that, was the language of a people, but for 2,000 years, if not dead, then at least, in something of a coma? Agnon and Chaim Nachman Bialik, the great national poet, they looked with a jaundiced eye at this idea that Hebrew was revived. And that Eliezer ben Yehuda, who was the hero of the story of the revival of the Hebrew language, had kind of done it single-handedly. Not just because there were egos involved, clearly there were, but in order for something to be revived, it has to first be dead. And Hebrew was never dead. Hebrew was always the language of prayer. It was always the language of scholarship. It was always the second language of Jews everywhere. Asterisk in the conversation. Yes, we acknowledge not everyone was learned. Not everyone was literate. Women in particular were probably not literate and fluent in Hebrew in any way near the same statistics as men, and certainly not as learned men. And of course, there were precious few learned women throughout much of that history. But you understand what I mean by Hebrew was the second language of Jews everywhere. So that if a Jew from Morocco and a Jew from Germany and a Jew from the Russian Pale of Settlement would meet on the streets of Vienna, they had a common language, and that was Hebrew. So Agnon didn't think that Hebrew needed to be revived. It needed to be reawoken, or in Amos Oz's felicitous phrase, like Sleeping Beauty. Hebrew was like Sleeping Beauty, which needed to be reawoken with the poet or the author's kiss. And the question then becomes, well, which Hebrew are we reawakening? How should the new language be reconstituted? How should it be brought, pulled into modernity? How could it be turned? How can the language of the synagogue and the study hall be turned into a language of modern literature? To say nothing of the language of the supermarket and the auto garage and the bus stop. And this was something about which there were ferocious debates throughout much of that period, particularly in that period of the second Aliyah, that decade in which Agnon first arrives in the land of Israel. That's when the most progress was made on these fronts. And Agnon really believed that modern Hebrew should emanate out of the sources of Jewish tradition, principally the rabbinic literature. So that today people who read Agnon, you know, there's this bad, it's a terrible mistake. What you might hear, particularly school children who might be forced some Agnon on the diet that's fed to them as part of the school curriculum, you can't read Agnon. It's written in, they don't even know enough to know which layer of Hebrew it's written in. But if they did, they would know that it's written with a very heavy dose of rabbinic Hebrew put on top of it. It's not true that contemporary Israelis can't read Agnon. Any contemporary Israeli can open Agnon and read him. And if they come across a concept or a word or a rabbinic phrase or a Talmudic idiom that's unfamiliar to them, well, you know, we're all carrying the collected wisdom of civilization in our pockets, and we can quickly, you know, Google something to find out. In the same way, by the way, that you know, it's a mistake to think that in the United States or in England, students or adults can't read Shakespeare. Shakespeare can be read and enjoyed by any somewhat intelligent reader, even though sometimes you need help getting over phrases and words. As a matter of fact, this past summer, we took our young children. Our younger children are 14 and 10. Then they were 13 and 9. We took them to see Shakespeare in the Park here in Jerusalem. There's a very, very good amateur production every summer of Shakespeare in the Park. And it's amazing how much they were able to enjoy it and how much of it they understood. And if that's true for Shakespeare, it's true even more so for Agnon. But there's no doubt that his Hebrew, the Hebrew of Agnon, is written in a high register. And it's not necessarily exactly contemporary spoken Hebrew. It actually reminds me, if we have time, I'll take us on a short detour, but I think you'll understand its value. In Greece, in modern Greece, as part of Greek nationalism and the revival of the Greek language as a modern language, there are some very many parallels. So what happened when Greece regained national sovereignty in the 19th century, they had similar debates about what kind of Greek should we be speaking. The distance between contemporary Greek and Homer is light years compared to the distance between contemporary Hebrew and rabbinic Hebrew, and even contemporary Hebrew and biblical Hebrew. So they created two forms of contemporary Greek. There was a kind of everyday Greek that you hear people speak in schools and in shops and on the bus and in taxicabs. And then there was what they call a purified Greek in a very high register. Now, this is not classic Greek. It's a kind of imagined form of what Greek would sound like if it emanated directly out of classical Greek. To a certain degree, and for many years in 20th century Greece, it was the official language. If you were a lawyer and you were arguing a case in court, if you were filing legal papers or doing something at a government office, business had to be conducted in High Greek. The nightly news was read in High Greek on the national station. The same way that here in Israel, the news on the radio was once read in a way that kind of, it was a higher register of Hebrew, besides the fact that in order to be a radio announcer in Israel, you had to be able to have perfect diction in the pronunciation of your modern Hebrew, and certainly without a whiff of any kind of Yiddishism or European type accent. Agnon is doing something similar. He's imagining what Hebrew would be like as a modern language without the historic catastrophe of which he spoke in Stockholm in 1966. How a modern language might have evolved directly from the sources of rabbinic literature without taking that detour, the tragic detours of Jewish history that we had to suffer. And that's what kind of sets his Hebrew somewhat apart. This was a bit of a digression, but I think it's an interesting one, or at least I think it's interesting. And it says something about what Agnonian Hebrew is, but I don't want to overstate it because it's used, unfortunately, as an excuse for people to feel something of a distance from Agnon. When with a little effort, there is no native Hebrew speaker that can't read and understand and enjoy Agnon's writings.
That's really interesting. And you mentioned women's relatively lower levels of education and familiarity with Hebrew in the times of Agnon's childhood. One of his famous novellas, Tehillah, is centers on a woman and her spirituality.
And these questions of disparate educational opportunities, which serves as part of the tragedy in that novella for what happens to the protagonist's daughter.
And do you think it has particular insight into female spirituality?
I think so. It's interesting. Agnon's depiction of women and female characters is a very interesting subject. It wasn't the subject of our book, although there's one particular essay by Professor Wendy Zeiler of New York, specifically on this subject and on this character of Tehillah and her parallels in other Hebrew and Yiddish literature, particularly by the author Dvorah Baron. And I think Wendy uncovers something actually quite groundbreaking in her essay about the sources and influences on Tehillah. But Agnon created many, many remarkable female characters in his writing. Very often the male protagonists are very passive. They're often acted upon. They're often, either the Luftmensch or the one who's disconnected. In Hebrew literature, it's called the Talush, the someone who kind of finds himself disconnected, doesn't fit in, is out of time, is out of place, is trying to struggle to find himself. But the women, the female characters, very often are dominant. Sometimes they're domineering, particularly the character of the mother in a few stories. And they're often the ones that take charge, and they're often the ones that move the plot. So I think there's something interesting to be said there. In Tehillah, of course, the very clear message is that part of the tragedy that befalls this, terribly tragic. It's a tragic story, you know, on the scale of we mentioned Greek a moment ago, of Greek tragedy, of what befalls that righteous woman, the character, the title character. But there's no doubt that she's saying something about the unequal opportunities that were afforded women and how they were drawn away to sometimes to Christianity, sometimes to leaving the faith in other ways, sometimes to running away from home in order to explore other opportunities, opportunities for love, opportunities for education, professional opportunities that were open to beginning to be open to women outside of the Jewish world. And then later, of course, these things were brought home inside the Jewish world.
Finally, Jeffrey, after spending so many years immersed in his work and then editing the 15-volume series of annotated translation, you have an intimate knowledge of Agnon. So tell us, in your view, what is his unique quality, the genius that makes him a giant of Israeli literature?
You've buried the lead, Renee. That's the great question. You know, look, every reader has the writers that resonate for them. Every reader has, you know, the bookshelf that they turn to, you know, for insight, for inspiration, for entertainment. You know, for me, you know, for many years, that's been Agnon. It really is a canon of works that you go back and you find new things in the foreword to one of the novels that we put out. I wrote an introduction, a preface, where I described my history with this particular novel, how I first encountered it as a young man in my 20s. And then I reread it again in my 30s. And then I had reread it again on the work for that book at that point in my 40s. And I was amazed that it was constantly, every time I came back to it, it was a different book. But of course, the book is the same. The reader has changed. And there are certain, you know, that's the definition of what makes a classic. A book that sustains ongoing engagement. And every time you come back to it, you're going to see something new in it because it's a reflection. It can be used as a lens back onto yourself. Agnon famously once said that any book not worth reading twice probably wasn't worth reading the first time. And that's true very often in Agnon. That's true not only to come back to it 5 or 10 years later, but to come back to it five minutes later. You finish reading it and you discover exactly how unreliable that narrator was and how many things you took for granted. And only when you get to the end do you discover, you know, what the theme of this work really is. And then you're inspired to go back and start from the beginning in order to take those insights and read it again. That's true for all classic literature. But I think that for, you know, Agnon has wide appeal. In my role at the Agnon House, I receive mails and phone calls and contacts from people all around the world, non-Jewish readers in, you wouldn't believe, in China, in Korea, in Saudi Arabia, where people encounter Agnon very often in the context of world literature courses or university lecturers who, you know, because the curriculum contains him, they have to learn something about him and they have to teach him and how much he resonates in other cultures. He's been translated to all world languages. But certainly for those of us that are engaged with Jewish life and Jewish learning and Jewish literature, you know, he's really exploring the themes that are central to our existence. And he's doing it through the raw material he has absorbed. Those of you that will come and visit us at the Agnon House in Jerusalem will see his vast library of many thousands, 9,000-10,000 volumes of the classics of Jewish literature spanning all time. We have some very rare books. The oldest book in our collection is a volume of medieval Jewish philosophy published in 1544. But of course, we have the classics of Jewish life and literature, not published, but going back to Moses on the mountain. And part of Agnon's accomplishment was to take the entirety of the Jewish canon and to distill it down and to cast it into the mold of modern literature. And that's something very creative. And particularly for people that are engaged with classic Jewish sources, to see how he uses, sometimes ironically, those sources to craft a modern literature is a very remarkable, to witness a very remarkable feat of creativity, of Jewish creativity, of authentic Jewish creativity. That's why I called it midrashic or pseudo-midrashic, because it's one text engaging with those that came before him. So in that regard, he's worthy of our attention. But the works themselves, even reading in translation, very often Israelis ask me, natural Israeli chauvinism, how could people possibly read Agnon in English? And I said, well, how did we in the United States, how did we read Tolstoy in English? How do we read Cervantes in English? How do we read any great classic in translation? Right? Those judges in Stockholm, and admittedly, there are all types of factors that go into awarding a Nobel to anyone and to anyone literature. But those judges in Stockholm all read Agnon in translation. And they understood this is a world-class author who's dealing both with a very high level of artistry and a very high level of insight to the human condition. And you know, for that alone, he's worth reading and coming back to again and again and again.
Well, he certainly is. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today, Jeffrey. And lots of good luck with your ongoing work.
Thank you.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov. To hear more conversations like this one, subscribe to the Van Leer Institute series on ideas on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform.